From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is out this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
I got a call early this morning. He said this was so great.
And that's Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer describing to the New York Times Donald Trump's absolute elation at good press.
And here's what he said. He said, "Do you watch Fox News?" I said, "Not really." He said, "They're praising you," meaning me. But he said, "And your stations," meaning, I guess, MSNBC, CNN, "are praising me. This is great."
This following the president's surprise deal last week with Democratic leaders on the debt ceiling, which actually wasn't so much of a deal as it was an agreement to kick the deal down the road for 3 months. And while that may sound like a punt, for the political press, it was a total game changer.
When we come back, is Donald Trump declaring his independence or just going rogue?
He is in many ways the first independent to hold the presidency since the advent of the current two-party system around the time of the Civil War.
Trump is a former Democrat, and so it's almost like his natural habitat is to deal with Democrats, but Republicans are just infuriated today.
So thrilled was the president with the press attention, he scheduled a second date this week with Democratic leaders to discuss DACA and a poo-poo platter of other issues over Chinese food. Here's The View from Fox Business.
President Trump is dining with the devil and his vampire bride as Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi have agreed to break bread and suck blood with the president. President Trump had a taste of that sweet bipartisan nectar after making the short-term debt ceiling deal with Chuck and Nance, and now he's addicted.
But as eager as the talking heads have been to cover each new plot twist, they seem decidedly less engaged in explaining just what those deals might mean. Take, for instance, the debt ceiling. For years, the media have treated the perennial debt ceiling debate like hurricane season. Is disaster heading to our shores? When will calamity strike? What's the projected damage? Often lost in the coverage, why we have to keep reliving this crisis in the first place. Zachary Carabel is head of global strategies at InvestNet. He's also author of The Leading Indicators, a short history of the numbers that rule our world. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Brooke.
Quick explainer, if you please. Step one, Congress passes a budget. Step two, it raises the debt ceiling to pay for it. But presumably our legislators have already made the hard choices in step one. So why do we have a step two?
So the debt ceiling is created 100 years ago. We're like at the 100th anniversary of the Federal Reserve and the 100th anniversary of the debt ceiling. Until 1917, the United States didn't tend to run budget deficits. So it was a rare thing, almost only in times of war, that you took on debt. And because it was a rare thing, whenever Congress decided that the federal government needed to borrow money, it would just authorize a bond issuance. There was no budget that was over budget until 1917. And there weren't a lot of budgets after 1917. The Great Depression during World War II were exceptions.
Mm-hmm. Now the government does borrow. There's a saying that the argument over the debt ceiling is basically legislative terrorism. It's been weaponized. By who?
Well, it was first weaponized by the Republicans, led by Newt Gingrich in 1995. So the first real hostage-taking situation, like change the budget or we'll shut down the government, was in 1995.
Speaker Gingrich said he and his new Republican congressional majority would force me, the congressional Democrats, and the American people to accept their budget and their contract by bringing about a crisis in the fall, by shutting down the government and pushing America into default.
There have been rumblings of it before, but it is primarily in modern history, if modern means the last 20 years, been a tool used by Republicans to force a discussion of cutting government spending. The debt ceiling as a tactic of a party to disrupt another party can certainly be effective, but when you are the governing party, i.e. the Republicans are now the governing party, the debt ceiling is a really inconvenient weapon for the minority voices within your own party to challenge you. So Paul Ryan's all for debt ceiling. We're not going to spend another dime and we're not going to borrow another dime until we cut spending. All for that when it's Republicans against Democrats. When it's Republicans against Republicans, the leadership isn't so fond of it.
And now it's being used principally by the Tea Party caucus. But why are the Democrats in such a rush?
So the goal for the Democrats was really keep this issue going because it will distract from other issues and it will be embarrassing. It is a marker whose only utility is to create political complications. Part of it is because over the past years, Congress has not passed a budget.
We see budgets being passed where appropriations change.
Right, but most of the budgets, certainly since 2008, have been continuing resolutions of the prior budget with some tweaking. We saw after 2013 with this thing, sequestration, right?
Mm-hmm. Meaning
we can't agree what parts of the government we want to cut or augment spending on. So we're just going to cut everything across the board by 10%. You have not really had a unified budget. Little pieces have been passed here and there, continuing resolutions to other pieces, a total hodgepodge. So because Congress can't agree on a budget, the debt ceiling authorization becomes the proxy for spending discipline that they can't embed in the budget process.
So if we're news consumers, what we hear, certainly from one side and sometimes from the other, is that spending is out of control.
Giving the federal government more money would be like giving a cocaine addict, all right, more cocaine.
It's certainly true that our aggregate debt is higher than it's ever been. It just passed $20 trillion. But the actual amount that we're paying to service that debt, which is the money that we spend annually, is lower than it was into the early 1980s, just because interest rates are so low. It's like a mortgage. I mean, it doesn't matter that you have $1 million mortgage or a $500,000 mortgage. It matters what your interest payments are on that mortgage. A 5% mortgage makes that really expensive, and a 2% mortgage makes it a lot less so. Same thing with the federal debt. You can argue about what cost would be unbearable. Paying 1.5% of your GDP on interest bearable and paying 3% not. Even if interest rates spiked, it's not as if our costs are going to go up 10x.
Okay, so give me a sense of perspective here.
Perspective in the media? Are you kidding?
Right now, what's our interest rate on the debt?
It's between 2 and 3%.
What was it 10 years ago?
4, 4.5, 5, before 2007. Interest rates peaked in 1982, more or less with some variability. They've just been coming down over the past 35 years.
Right now, our debt exceeds the gross domestic product, how much value we produce over the course of a year.
Yeah.
Again, some more perspective. How does that compare to, say, the 80s or the 90s?
It's been creeping up year by year. There was some deficit reduction, as you know, under Clinton. But overall, our debt levels have been going up and up and up. Not all that debt is owed. You know, a lot of it's the government writing IOUs to itself. Some of it is kind of an accounting fiction. So we borrow money from ourselves to pay ourselves.
And the size of the debt doesn't matter?
At some point, it matters. I'm simply saying we are way, way away from that point.
Mm-hmm.
And the Tea Party is saying we're way, way beyond that point.
It doesn't seem as if the debt is the boogeyman that it was 4 or 5 years ago. Then the rhetoric around it and what we were doing to our children would just cause spontaneous combustion.
When we see our nation destroying our children's future by settling with a debt they can't handle, we've got to do something about that.
We can't mortgage our children's future on a mountain of debt.
During the time when S&P downgraded the U.S. debt in 2011, there were other debates, 2011, 12, 13, where debt was on the top of the agenda when people were surveyed as their main concerns. That was very high. And I wrote pieces somewhat arguing we should look at the interest payments on the debt, we should look at the servicing, not the absolute level. Debt can be a tool if it's used wisely. And the amount of hate mail and anger that that generated in people. The joke at the time is I could write an article in favor of child pornography and I would have received less angry responses than I did suggesting that maybe the levels of absolute debt were not so critical to our future. I mean, I literally was called a hater of America, wanted to destroy the American future.
And why not that kind of pushback now?
To some degree, it's just cyclical. So healthcare some years is a huge deal, other years it's not. Terrorism, you know, rises or falls. Climate change, same thing. Part of it is a media cycle of no one story can gain traction for too long. I mean, the narrative does have to change. Even in the primaries with the Republicans, debt levels were not the issue.
Oh, that's true.
This really waned after 2014. You could say the Republicans gaining control of the House in such a commanding way. I also think the fact that the economy has stabilized, I mean, you can argue about how bad or good it is for many of us, but it's clearly stabilized over the past 4 or 5 years, which is an offsetting factor to the level of fear. American attitudes towards debt have been emotional for a long time, and maybe they'll come to the fore again next year as Trump ratchets up the rhetoric about our dependency on others, right? China holds our debt, Mexico's stealing our jobs, you know, whatever the next wave of us and them is, debt can easily feed into that. So I wouldn't call it a day on this as being a source of hysteria. It's just been an abeyance.
When you're watching the news, you know, annually during this time, what's the thing that makes you want to tear out your hair?
Well, what hair there is, the thing that aggravates me the most is we ought to be holding Congress much more accountable for not passing budgets. Dealing with the country's finances, deciding what to spend, is one of the central functions of the legislative body. So in a weird way, the debt ceiling prevents the hard work.
So are you suggesting people just skip over the debt ceiling stories?
Yeah. There's no there. But the minority who want to use it as a tool, like this is the only way in which the Freedom Caucus, the current group of Republicans who were elected on a government spending's out of control, debt is going to destroy us, we have to change this or else we're all going to collapse in the face of the Chinese or the banks or whomever else. This is the major point of leverage that that group has. There's already a fracture going on within the Republican Party. If you get rid of the debt ceiling right now, you really risk that fracture becoming outright civil war.
But if you took politics out of it, it doesn't make any sense to have a debt ceiling.
Yeah, if you took politics out of it, a lot of this wouldn't make sense. It would be kind of the, you know, other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how did you like the play?
All right, Zachary, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Zachary Carabel is author of The Leading Indicators, a short history of the numbers that rule our world. Coming up, what do medieval history and Taylor Swift have in common? This is On the Media.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.